fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, a happy Holy Week to you. We're going to have a great time this week. This is one of the most beautiful times of the year. It's really my favorite week of the year, Holy Week, and I'm so glad that we get to spend it here on the Cale Clark Show. You can call this number right now, 888-914-9149 to talk to me for free, 888-914-9149. You can also email the program, become a shadow producer, send me a show idea. The address is Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. You can also find me on the X app at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. But don't forget that phone number, sponsored by the Catholic Order of Foresters Life Insurance, 888-914-9149. We have a lot to get to today. We're going to dive deep into the scriptures of Holy Week. You're going to walk very closely with Jesus through this week. It's going to be something that's going to be hopefully a spiritual experience. I think we're going to learn a lot together. So I can't wait to dive in. But I just also want to tease some other things that we're going to talk about today. As we go forward, we're going to talk about how you spend Holy Week in the family. What are some special family traditions that you might have at home for Holy Week? I'm going to share what one family is doing. It might spur you, give you some ideas, and maybe you have your own Easter traditions, Holy Week traditions that you want to share. There's also some very special plenary indulgences that you can get this week. So we need to talk about those. We're going to talk about Big Maple. I'll tell you who he is later. Big Maple in the Sweet 16. That sounds pretty delicious. And Say It Ain't So Show. Say It Ain't So. Forget about Shoeless Joe. We got maybe Shoeless Show. Shohei Ohtani is in the hot seat. Did he gamble on Major League Baseball? Ooh, this is a big, big story. He just addressed the media just a few minutes ago. As opening day is approaching, this is not the story that Major League Baseball wants to be in the media. But we're going to talk right now about pouring out your life for Jesus. The extravagant gift of Jesus' sacrifice, plus a pretty extravagant gift that was given to him as well. But just before we mention that, I would be very remiss if I didn't tell you that today is my mom's birthday. So pray for my mom, Kathy. We'll talk to you later tonight, Mom, but it's your birthday, and we love you. We're so, I'm so happy you're my mom. I think everyone would say that, right? I mean, this is one of the arguments that's used about how Jesus looked after his mom, assumed her into heaven, did all these things for her. Wouldn't you do the same for your mom if you could, if you were God? And that's exactly what Jesus did. But having said that, today, of course, is usually March 25th, the Feast of the Annunciation. But because it's Holy Week, it actually gets moved. It's going to be moved to April the 8th, in case you're wondering, because it might be a bit of a head scratcher because clearly, we did have the Solemnity of St. Joseph during Lent, and that was fine. But because it is Holy Week, even such a feast as the Annunciation, which of course means there's exactly 9 months, 9 shopping months left until Christmas, not to put that idea in your head, but 9 months until Christmas, the Incarnation, we're going to move that to the 8th of April. That's what the bishops have done. And so that's what we're doing. So let's talk a little bit about today's gospel reading, because it's one of my favorites. I just absolutely love this. This is from John chapter 12. Listen to this. It says, 6 days before Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Now, of course, back in chapter 11, that was the whole account of Jesus raising Lazarus. They gave a dinner for him there, and Martha served while Lazarus was one of those reclining at table with him. Mary took a liter of costly perfumed oil made from genuine aromatic nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and dried them with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. Then Judas the Iscariot, one of his disciples and the one who would betray him, said, "Why was this oil not sold for 300 days' wages and given to the poor?" I mean, it's very expensive. He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief and held the money bag and used to steal the contributions. So Jesus said, "Leave her alone. Let her keep this for the day of my burial. You always have the poor with you, but you do not always have me. The large crowd of the Jews found out that he was there and came not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. And the chief priests plotted to kill Lazarus too, because many of the Jews were turning away and believing in Jesus because of him. All right, so this is a really powerful reading from John chapter 12. And just a few notes on this, by the way. Something we need to talk about here. It's interesting because there's sort of a, I guess, a thought pattern out there in biblical studies that people want to say, well, Mark's gospel, which was the first gospel written, then Matthew, then Luke, the synoptic gospels, they're the ones that you can kind of count on with respect to history, the when things actually happen. Some people want to say John is not historical. It's so theological, and it's true. John is a very theological gospel. It's very high-flying. It's kind of what's going on Earth from heaven's perspective. That's why John is symbolized by the eagle, his gospel. It really does fly high. But saying that John isn't historical, I think this is one place where John actually has the dates right about when things happened, because this account of this woman who, and John says it's Mary, the sister of Lazarus, the sister of Martha, who anoints Jesus with this incredibly expensive perfume called nard. It actually sources from India in an alabaster jar. Pricey, pricey stuff. This is not Chanel No. 5, okay? This is another realm altogether. And in this alabaster jar would have, it had a very thin, kind of elegant neck on the jar. And how you open it is you crack it open. You crack open the neck. And it looks like she poured out the entire jar. I mean, and as noted there, Judas complains about it. Hey, this is almost a year's wages. What the heck? And so the whole thing was poured out on Jesus. Now, I'm assuming this is like kind of a Tom Ford type of scent. You know, it's kind of manly. You know, this Jesus doesn't want to walk around. Hey, if this is Martha's perfume, come on, I don't want this. But no, all kidding aside, This is done for a specific reason, a theological reason, which we'll get into in just a second. But in Mark's gospel in chapter 14, which Matthew kind of picks up on, by the way, in Matthew 26, it's an unnamed woman who anoints Jesus, and it's the night, the last night of his life. It's Holy Thursday, just before he's arrested, sort of in the context of the Last Supper, the First Mass. But John actually has this in a different place, and I do think it's the same event. He says it's 6 days before the Passover. So essentially, it's Palm Saturday, if you will, Palm Saturday. So as we get into this week that changed the world, Holy Week, as we're going to walk with Jesus through it, I do think John actually has this right historically. I don't think this happened the night of the Last Supper, the First Mass. And they say, well, hang on here. How can the gospel be true if that's the case? John has it right. That means the others have it wrong. What's going on here? Or maybe some say there are two anointings. Well, this happened, and then another woman anointed Jesus at the Last Supper. What's going on here? Okay, I think John has it right in this case, but what's happening here is something called displacement. Displacement. This is how people did history in the ancient world in the first century. The Gospels are first century Greco-Roman historical biographies of Jesus, okay? They are historical, but the way that they did history in the first century is different from the way that people write historical biographies now. So, for example, if you've read the new biography of Elon Musk by Walter Isaacson, who's also profiled Benjamin Franklin, Steve Jobs, he's done lots of work. Isaacson's writing by different rules than what's going on here, okay? But just because the rules are a little different doesn't mean that it's wrong, that it's not historical. So let's think of it this way. If, let's say, major events in Jesus's life, let's say they're represented by blocks, just like kids play with Lego blocks. Let's say you have all those blocks in a row. This is the order in which they happened, okay? The ancient writer has the freedom to actually move those blocks around. So he can take an incident that happened at this time, and he can move it to an earlier time or a later time in his in his account of Jesus's life if he wants to make a certain point, or if he wants to emphasize this for a certain reason. There may be all kinds of factoids that would make him want to do this, but that does not mean that it's bad history. It's the way that they did it in the first century. It's totally fine. It's totally fine. The one thing you were not allowed to do is make stuff up whole cloth. You couldn't do that, but you were allowed to move things around. You could compress the story a little bit, make it a little bit shorter if you needed to, expand it if you needed to. You weren't allowed to invent things, though. And by the way, John does this in another place as well. When Jesus cleanses the temple, it's in John chapter 2. It's at the very beginning of the gospel. John, in this case, I don't think he has it in the right historical place when it actually happened, because the other gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, have Jesus cleansing the temple in Holy Week, the last week of his life. And this is one of the things that sets off the religious leaders saying, we absolutely have to take this guy out. He's out of control. We have to kill him because he's causing too many problems here. This is a huge disturbance. He's making us look really bad. I think so. John moves this. I think some people say, no, there are two cleansings. He did it twice, once at the beginning of his ministry, once at the end. It's possible, but I think John moves it to the beginning for a certain theological reason. But I do think it actually happened in Holy Week. But in this case, this idea of Mary of Bethany anointing Jesus, I do think this happened not the night of the Last Supper, the first Mass, but actually before, on Palm Saturday, if you will, 6 days before the Passover feast, Saturday night before Palm Sunday. All right. So having said that, just I don't want you to get confused, because when you read the Gospels closely, you might think, this doesn't make sense. Why is this in a different place? Did this happen more than once? This is just how ancient biographies are written in the first century. Not a big deal, but it's totally historical. Absolutely. All right. So it's kind of relocated the story here. And you say, what about Luke chapter 7? There's another incident with a sinful woman pouring a flask of ointment on Jesus' head. I think this is a totally different thing. This is not the same incident. This is a different incident because, number one, it's ointment, it's not perfume, and it's a totally different conversation about a different topic. It's about this woman with a sinful past, talking about her salvation. This is totally different from what's going on here in John, where this, Mark says it's an alabaster container. John says, you know, he mentions this idea of Jesus' feet being wiped by Mary's hair as well. I think that's a different woman. But anyways, I don't want to confuse you any more than that. But here's the deal. So there's a big meal that's happening in Bethany. And some people say it's at the house of Mary, Martha, and Lazarus, these siblings. And right before this, don't forget, Jesus has raised Lazarus from the dead. He's resuscitated him. This is unbelievable. It's stupendous. But actually, whose house is this really? I don't think it's actually at their house. I don't think it's at Lazarus's house, Martha and Mary's house, assuming that they all lived in the same home. You know, the Dead Sea Scrolls, it's kind of interesting. The Dead Sea Scrolls, and there's one of the Dead Sea Scrolls that was found by the Dead Sea in the wilderness, in the caves at Qumran. It was found in cave number 11. It's called the Temple Scroll. In the Temple Scroll, it actually says that there was a leper colony on the outskirts of Bethany. And that's, of course, the village where Mary, Martha, and Lazarus lived. There was a leper colony nearby. So whose house is this? It actually probably is the house of Simon the leper. Now, Simon the leper is mentioned in Mark chapter 14, verse 3. He says that the meal happened there. So here's what probably happened. This is kind of a reconstruction that one scholar kind of comes up with. Because Simon was a leper, okay, how in the world is he hosting a dinner at his house? Because remember, lepers are unclean. You can't come near them. Well, probably because Jesus has healed him, and he's now clean. He's now ritually clean. He can have people over to his house. In all likelihood, Simon the leper is not married. Because again, his leprosy would have, you know, made it a little bit difficult to go out on dates. You know, he's not swiping left or anything like that. You know, his fingers are falling off. No, I'm only kidding. That probably wasn't that bad. But hey, you can't go near this guy. Can't touch this, as MC Hammer would say. So in all likelihood, he's probably unmarried. That's why it says that Martha prepared the meal. And this is exactly the same portrayal of these two sisters, by the way, that we see in Luke chapter 10, where Mary is sitting at the feet of Jesus, and she's just like, she's very spiritual, kind of soaking it up, and Martha's the active one. This whole idea, Mary's contemplative, Martha's active. You know, why don't you tell my sister to help with the serving, Jesus? Come on, I'm dying over here. But really, we kind of need to combine those two lives in our own life, the active and the contemplative life. We do have to serve Jesus and others actively, as Martha did, but we have to do it while at the same time being contemplatives like Mary. So the contemplation really needs to drive the action. And St. Jose Maria said that we have to be contemplatives in the middle of the world. Yeah, we do live in the middle of the working world, but we have to be contemplating Jesus in the middle of the street. And that's sometimes a challenge for sure. But in all likelihood, probably what happened was Simon the leper says, hey, I want to host this big party for Jesus. Can you please cook? Can you bring over stuff? Or just bring over stuff and you can cook it at my place. I've got a pretty cool KitchenAid stove you can use, and sure, no problem, I can do that. So it's not Martha and Mary in Lazarus's house. It's probably the house of Simon the leper. Plus, we see that Lazarus himself is reclining there. He's just kind of chilling out. That's not what you would do if you're the host. You would be sort of serving and trying to help in some way too. So this is a bizarre incident too, with the whole concept of, by the way, Mary taking the perfumed oil, you know, the Tom Ford cologne, if you will, made from genuine aromatic nard, and anointing Jesus. You would never make this up if this didn't happen historically, by the way. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Welcome to Holy Week. We're going to walk with Jesus through the week that changed the world here. And so this is today's gospel. This idea that she would pour all this, you know, on Jesus and then dry his feet with her hair. You would never invent such a thing. You would never invent such a thing unless it actually happened. Why? Because in the ancient world, this action of, you know, wiping his feet with her hair, that kind of thing, it would be perceived as kind of a sensual thing, you know, sort of, you know, kind of a romantic gesture, let's put it that way. Okay, clearly that's not what was going on, but you would never say this unless this actually happened. And then this whole concept that John says the house was filled with the fragrance. I mean, it was powerful. It was all, open a window here. If you don't like it, no sense is good sense. not in this case. That sounds like a personal memory from someone who was there. And by the way, sense... memories, and by that S-C-E-N-T-S, we remember things, right? Things that certain smells of certain times, like whether it's our grandma's home cooking or whatever it might be, smells are very associated with powerful memories that we have of different events in our life. So that obviously stuck out pretty big time in John's memory. So again, this is a lavish, extravagant amount of ointment, very expensive, huge quantities. And what she's really doing there is she is essentially anointing Jesus in advance for his burial, which is coming. Just like when, and we can see this in the Gospels too, when Jesus is put in the tomb, there are huge quantities of spices and aloe and myrrh that's used to anoint the body. This is the same kind of lavish amount. It also kind of echoes the priesthood of Jesus, if you will, that Jesus is really our great high priest, because in the Old Testament, it talks about precious oil in Psalm 133 being poured on the head of Aaron, the high priest, running down his beard onto the collar of his robes, like the dew of Hermon falling on Mount Zion. So oil everywhere. Just like this anointing, it just covers Jesus, it even drips down onto his feet. This is a big deal. So he is absolutely fully anointed here from head to toe. And this is exactly what you would do if you really, really, really wanted to show absolutely extreme hospitality, as well as anoint him, foreshadowing his burial here. And Judas, of course, here, Judas is like, this is ridiculous. This is a total waste. And by the way, in Mark's version and in Matthew's version, it's not named who says this. It just says one of the disciples complained about it. Well, John calls him out. He says, it's definitely Judas. Okay. That guy. And so this could have been spent on the poor. And by the way, this kind of complaint, this comes back to Catholics all the time, doesn't it? why doesn't the Catholic Church sell all of their precious, like the Vatican museums, all the incredible art, sell it, give it to the poor? That would be a much better use of this. Why do you need these expensive chalices and vestments? Why do you need to festoon your parishes with all this beautiful artwork? Can't you just have a bare bones, stripped down hall, if you will, to worship in and give the money to the poor? This is frivolous. This is frivolous. Well, we know we do this to honor Jesus. We do this to show our love for Jesus. But of course, Judas is being totally hypocritical here. He was constantly pilfering, offering from the money bags and spending it on himself, investing in Bitcoin or who knows what. But speaking of coins, there'd be some other coins that he would have to deal with, these 30 pieces of silver. But he just didn't get the love that Mary had, which was behind the whole thing. He doesn't understand this. He absolutely doesn't. And it completely, by the way, anticipates his coming betrayal, which is going to happen. And maybe this is just one more thing which made Judas want to betray our Lord. But at any rate, can you imagine? The word gets out, Jesus is in town. He's just done the biggest miracle that he's ever done in John's gospel. These great signs that he produces as evidence of of who he is, his identity. He's raised Lazarus from the dead. He's the way, the truth, and the life. He's overcome death. And so everybody wants to see Jesus, and they also want to see Lazarus, because I want to see this guy back from the dead. And John says that the high priest and his cronies, the chief priests, want to also kill now Lazarus, because he's evidence that good stuff is happening here. We can't have this. We've got to take him out. And Lazarus is probably thinking, man, I don't want to go through that again. I just went through death. I thank you very much. I'll take a break for a little while before I have. And he would have to die again because he wasn't resurrected. He was simply resuscitated, but he wasn't in a hurry to go through that again. But it just kind of shows you that really no good deed goes unpunished, certainly in the case of Jesus. And it's hard to say whether the high priest and his cronies, whether they actually believed that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. It seems like they didn't. I would probably say that they didn't believe it. They didn't buy it. But who knows? Who knows for sure? Maybe they did see it and they didn't know it somehow and still decided to reject him. So miracles have this, they don't always give the incontrovertible proof that one might wish. And Jesus says, hey, a wicked and adulterous generation asks for a sign, but no sign will be given it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. So this is an incredible gospel, and there's so much to talk about here. We're going to take a quick break right now, but if you want to call in, 888-914-9149. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. It is Holy Week, Monday of Holy Week, 888-914-9149. Be right back.
The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149. It's the number to call toll free to talk to me. And you just heard about Father Rocky's pilgrimage to Poland and Prague. Well, speaking of Father, he celebrated his 65th birthday on Saturday. What a celebration. So happy birthday, Father. I know he had a great party at Relevant Radio. If you go on Twitter, actually, you can see on the Relevant Radio account some fun photos from that day. He appeared on the Drew Mariani Show. They had a lot of fun. But I want you to know, speaking of Father, that you can complete your Lenten journey with Jesus, with Father's help, close to Jesus to the last. It's a 5-day spiritual walkthrough of Jesus's final days before his passion. And Father Rocky will guide you through this. We'll pause for an hour every day this week at 11 a.m. Central and 6 p.m. Central. So right after this program, we're going to ponder the events that culminated Calvary, exploring each one with specially selected music and prayers today all the way through Good Friday. By the way, you can find a guide to all of our special Holy Week programming at relevantradio.com/ holy-week. relevantradio.com/holy, and then there's a dash, week. Okay, so don't forget that. Lots of fun stuff coming up on Thursday. We've got the truth of the tritium on the Faith Explained show as well. And actually tomorrow on the Faith Explained, we're going to be going through 27 messianic prophecies, fulfillments of scripture that Jesus performed in one day. In one day, he fulfilled 27 messianic prophecies. It's amazing. He fulfilled over 300 in total, but we'll go through the 27 that he did from Holy Thursday onto Good Friday tomorrow on the Faith Explained, 12:30 Central, right here on Relevant Radio. Well, back now on the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149. We've been talking about Mary of Bethany, of course. She is the sister of Lazarus, the sister of Martha as well. And this big party that was hosted probably by Simon the leper just outside of Bethany. And it was really a celebration of Jesus and how he brought Lazarus back to life. And Mary just pours out this very expensive aromatic nard perfume, anoints Jesus with it. This costs almost a year's wages, about 300 days' wages. Unbelievable. Not counting vacation days either. And Judas objects to this. He's totally hypocritical. He says the money could have been spent on the poor, but clearly he would have wanted to steal those funds, as he was wont to do, dipping into the bag, as it were. He was the treasurer of the apostolic band, and he was not trustworthy at all. And, you know, there's a writer who kind of makes a jarring point about this, actually, that he says that in everybody's heart, really kind of, there's really kind of two souls that live within everybody. I mean, it's an analogy. We don't have two souls. We only have one soul. But he says, really, each of us have a Judas soul within us and a Mary soul within us, like Mary of Bethany. Judas obviously causes all kinds of Jesus' suffering. He's always ready to betray the faith. He's always ready to give the traitor's kiss. And we've got to kind of kill that guy within us, right? We've got to push him down. We've got to master him. We've got to make sure that he never gets out of the box. Then we have a Mary soul as well. And Mary is obviously a source of comfort to Jesus. She listens to him, soaks in his teachings, and that kind of soaks him in this perfume and just gives him comfort in his sufferings. And so we've really got to let this Mary soul within us win. And Father Pius Parsh kind of made this analogy. It's very striking. It's very striking, the juxtaposition between these two. And he said really that this happened with Christ's physical body. Mary anointed him, sat at his feet. Judas resents this, and he decides, I'm going to betray this guy. I'm going to have him killed. And this is exactly how everyone ultimately reacts to Christ. I mean, you can't really be neutral when it comes to Jesus. So even in his mystical body, even in the church, this is exactly how people react. There are people who anoint him, and then there are people who kind of give him the Judas kiss. There are people who give Jesus love and service, and there are people who essentially crucify him with their deeds. And this is pretty striking. St. Augustine said this, by the way: if you want to be more like Martha, how can you anoint the body of Christ? Well, he said this. He said, you can anoint Jesus' feet with a life pleasing to God. Follow in his footsteps. That's how you can anoint his feet. Follow in his ways. And if you have an abundance, give it to the poor. Because in this way, you can wipe, you can anoint the feet of the Lord, the mystical Christ, the body of Christ. So that's a good comfort for Jesus, because he's always throughout history receiving all kinds of Judas kisses. And they're really the ones that hurt the most, because they're the sins of his friends, the sins of Catholics, the sins of people who profess to believe in Jesus. Those are the sins that hurt him the most. And so we don't want to do that. We want to have more of a heart like Mary's as we go through this Holy Week during Lent. You're listening to the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149. Let's go to line three. Let's go to Emmett in New York. Hi, Emmett.
Hello, Cale. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope I'm not catching you off topic. A few weeks ago, I was in a car, so I couldn't write down anything. Mm-hmm. You had mentioned that you knew someone who wrote a book on ancient Jewish burial customs.
Yes. Yeah.
I was wondering if you could give me any information on that, because that would be a good place for me to start. I just have questions about the image on the Shroud of Turin, not the cloth itself, but the image.
Okay. That's interesting. Okay, so I'm trying to remember what book I might have been referencing. Now, there are some scholarly like works. If you really want to do an academic deep dive on this, the late Professor Raquel Hochlili, an Israeli scholar, a very, very gracious, elegant, lovely woman, incredible scholar. Unfortunately, she passed away recently, but I was able to visit her during one of my study trips in Israel, and along with Professor Craig Evans, and she was very, very gracious to us and gave us a lot of incredible information. So she's written a lot about this on the academic side of things. Dr. Craig Evans has a book called Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence, and he kind of goes into, he's got a chapter there on Jewish burial, which is kind of more accessible to a lay audience a little bit, and that's that kind of goes through it. And I'll also deal with this a little bit later this week on Wednesday on the Faith Explained show. I'm going to be talking about getting the death and burial of Jesus right. It's very important that we do that, because there's so many misconceptions about this and how it was done in the first century world. So hopefully that'll be of help to you as well, Emmett.
With a book by Dr. Craig Evans, please.
Yeah, the book by Dr. Craig Evans is called Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. He's got a good chapter in there on the burial. So that's one I recommend. It's got a lot of other great stuff in there too. So hopefully that helps, Emmett. And I'm going to try to think of another resource for you as well. So stay tuned. I'll try to find that before the end of the show, Lord willing. And thanks for your call, Emmett from New York. God bless you. God bless you. And if you missed what I said, again, just check the podcast. If you didn't, you might be in the car again. Who knows? RelevantRadio.com. You can look at our shows, or you can simply go to the Relevant Radio app and you can download and stream this podcast. We're also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify. We're everywhere that you are, as we want to bring Christ to the world through the media. And we live in a media-saturated world for sure, and we definitely want to take some time to pray a little bit more this week. So what are some of your Holy Week traditions? I really want to know. 888-914-9149. I read a little piece that kind of got me thinking a little bit. It was from the National Catholic Register. There's a theology professor at a Catholic high school. He talked about how he does it in his family. He's got two young boys, and obviously the ages of your kids kind of affect things a little bit, what you can do, what they can understand, what they can grasp. But what traditions were important to you growing up, or what are some of the ones that you have in your own home? Whether you have a big family, no family at all, maybe you're living on your own, and this is what you do every week. 888-914-9149. So Thomas Griffin wrote this little piece, and he said that really, like, he loves doing this in Lent, specifically trying to inculcate the Catholic faith in his kids. He's got a wife named Joanna, and they've got two boys, Benedict, who's three, Gabriel, who's one. So of course they try as best they can to say grace before meals, go to Sunday Mass, obviously that's a must, bedtime prayers, and it's not always easy just even to get the basics done with kids, for sure, as you know, if you're a parent. But obviously Holy Week is pretty challenging, because there are a lot of extra long masses and services, like Good Friday. It's a service, it's not a mass. It's the only day of the year in the Catholic Church where there's a service. Having said that, and some of these, of course, are not holy days of obligation per se, but most people do try to make it out if they can. Palm Sunday, obviously this happened yesterday. The long gospel reading can be pretty tough for some young people to get through. I know it was tough for me when I was a kid, for sure, but there are ways to kind of get the kids into it. So what Thomas Griffin does with his family is they make a commitment to wear red as a family, because that's the liturgical color of the day. I don't know if you've ever done that. There used to be a very elegant woman from an Indian background at my parish who used to wear a sari, a beautiful sari. And every day she would actually match her sari to the liturgical color. And that's true. That was true for daily mass as well. If it was a saint's day, she'd wear white. If it was Lent, she'd wear purple. If it was a weekday, you know, that whole thing. So I don't have that many outfits. I don't know. So, but did you ever do anything like that? Wear the liturgical color as a family? But it was just a way for them to sort of say this day is a little bit different from another Sunday. Obviously the palms as well. So it's kind of crucial to remind the kids that some different things are going to happen this week than what you're used to. And then their family tradition also is they go shopping on Wednesday to buy the food that they're going to have, that they're going to eat on Holy Thursday. And then they try to kind of eat it as Jesus and his disciples would have eaten the Last Supper, which eventually the first Mass is part of that as well. But the way that they do it is they kind of take the coffee table and they make that sort of their dinner table and they recline on pillows on the floor. Now, that's actually kind of biblical. I don't know if you've been to the Holy Land. I don't know if you've ever been to Nazareth, but there's a place in Nazareth called Nazareth Village where they try to recreate the first century town of Nazareth that Jesus would have grown up in. And they have people dressed up in period costumes, if you will, farmers and stuff like that. And then there are little homes. There's some little homes. And one of them is supposed to be allegedly like the home of the Holy Family, Jesus, Mary, and Joseph. But when you go in there, and I think it was put together by, and I don't know who did this. I don't know who's responsible for it, but there's a bit of an anachronism there because you go into where the family area is, and there's a table and chairs such as you would find at a local furniture store. And it's made with nice wood, don't get me wrong, but they'll say, yeah, this is the kind of stuff that Jesus and Joseph would have made in the carpentry shop, and you know, see the fine grain wood here. That's actually not what they used. They did not use a table and chairs like we have today. They would have reclined on the floor exactly like this family tries to kind of reenact it a little bit. What would the table be made from? Probably the table would be stone, to be honest with you. It'd be very, very low to the ground, probably made of stone. And then there is how you would sort of sidle up to the table. You'd actually recline. You'd lay on your side. You'd kind of be propped up on your elbow. It's kind of like you're chilling out, maybe on some pillows. And then you're propped up with one elbow, and then you eat with the other hand. And so obviously the closer you are to the host or the guest of honor, the more esteemed your position is. So this is why John the Apostle, the beloved disciple, you know, he's very close to Jesus at the Last Supper. That's why Peter has to ask him, hey, can you please, John, ask Jesus who's going to betray him? And he whispered in his ear or something. Okay, all right, Jesus, who's going to betray you? That's the guy who's going to dip his bread in the olive oil right now. And then Judas does it, right? So this is how he gets kind of close. So everyone would kind of be lying on their side around this table, maybe people sort of closer to the back, and that's how it kind of works. So kind of intriguing. So that's an interesting tradition this family does on Holy Thursday, as Jesus had his final meal with his friends before the resurrection. And then the foot washing scene, it sounds like they kind of reenact that in their own family a little bit. And then on Good Friday, obviously they try to explain to the kids that this is a very, very different day. It's an incredibly important day. They try to do the Stations of the Cross with their kids, but they only do three of them because the kids are, remember, 3 years old and 1 year old, respectively. Attention spans are not that long, but they'll teach the kids eugenioflect at this point as you're going through the Stations of the Cross, and they'll ask their children, hey, what happened to Jesus? Why did he do this for you? They'll have them, kids, look at a crucifix. And 3-year-old Benedict would say, he got nailed to the cross because he loved me and daddy and mommy and my brother. Yeah, him too. And so Holy Saturday, this is a good one for Holy Saturday. They go to a church, and obviously the Blessed Sacrament is removed. It's a totally different ballgame when Jesus is not in the building. But then they leave a bouquet of flowers for Our Lady. That's a great tradition for Holy Saturday, because she's the only one who never really lost hope. She never lost hope. And they can talk to the kids how they can always go to Jesus' mom when they're feeling sad, because she knew what it was like to feel sad as well. All right. Back in a minute. We got to take a quick break here on the Cale Clark Show, 888-914-9149. Be right back.
This is the Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back to the Cale Clark Show on this Monday of Holy Week. So good to be with you. Hey, for those of you who are following March Madness, whew, how's your bracket looking? Has it been busted? I'm okay. I'm still okay. I'm going to bring in producer Jim here right now. And both of us, we both picked the same team to win. We picked Purdue to get off the schneid. They were had a first round exit. I'm kind of hoping that they'll be like Virginia was a few years ago, where they were expected to win it all, went out in the first round. Super embarrassing. It was the first time a number one seed ever lost to a 16 seed. Same thing happened to Purdue last year. But this year they got through the first round, they're through the second round, and they're into the Sweet 16, led by Big Maple. Yes, he's from Canada. He's 7'4", 300 pounds. I don't know how about what that is in kilograms. I have no idea. But having said that, Zach Edey from Toronto, the city where I live, and he's a big dude. And here's a clip called by the great Kevin Harlan, by the way, from some March Madness action with Purdue. Check this out.
Edey from Jones, lands Jones the assist. Adugie rejected by Edey. Lawyer got the screen from Kaufman Ring. Edey dodging, shooting, scoring.
All right, was that from the Utah State game, Jim? Or all right, fantastic. Yep. Yeah, they scored over 100 points in that game. And now, producer Jim, your wife went to Purdue, so you're contractually obligated to pull for them in this tournament. but yeah, no, it's you know what's amazing, too? You're a hockey fan, I know, a big fan of the St. Louis Blues. Will they make the playoffs is another story.
Yeah,
they
that's
might.
True.
They just might. But Zach Edey, growing up in Toronto, he actually was pretty proficient at a few different sports. He pitched in baseball and was actually... I mean, imagine this guy in the mound. Forget about Randy Johnson, if you remember him. 7'4", 300 pounds, just throwing heat at you. Can you imagine that? And also, he played a little hockey, too, as a defenseman. Think about this. On skates, okay, he's 7'4". On skates, he's about 7'9". Can you imagine that freight train coming at you? Oh, my goodness. Wow. But obviously, he picked basketball. He's not that I ever saw Will Chamberlain play, but he's as dominant as I think Will Chamberlain used to be. Unbelievable. He certainly looks like a man among boys out there. Yeah, we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. But my bracket's a little bit damaged. I had picked, speaking about first round upsets, I picked Kentucky to make it into the Final Four. I don't know why I did that. They obviously lost to Oakland, huge upset in the first round. I think that destroyed a lot of people's brackets. But so my South region is not looking great, but the Midwest I'm looking pretty good. I've still got three of my four Final Four teams, Jim. I've got UConn, Arizona, Purdue, and I had UK. That's not going to happen, obviously. But how about you?
Yeah, so it's not doing too bad. It could be doing a lot better, but I actually had Michigan State kind of making it through and going up against Purdue, but they obviously were beat by a very dominant North Carolina team the other day. Mm-hmm. So I actually picked Oakland was an upset for me. So as bad as my bracket looks, at least I got that one right. But it's been a fun weekend of college basketball, and I'm looking for Purdue to do really strong performance next weekend against Gonzaga. But they've got a tough team too, so they've got the work cut out for them.
They sure do. That's going to be the Sweet 16 is going to be fantastic. It's going to be really some great matchups in the South. Houston against Duke, NC State, surprising run from NC State. They did win the ACC tournament, but didn't have the greatest of regular seasons. But they're getting hot at the right time. They're playing Marquette. I know the great John Hanratty has Marquette, I think, winning it all this year. Purdue against Gonzaga, the Creighton Blue Jays against Tennessee. In the West region, UNC, Carolina going up against Arizona. And the Illini, Rich Pozinski will be happy. The Fighting Illini going up against UConn. Oh no, that's I'm sorry. I'm reading to you my Elite Eight. I'm getting way ahead of myself. UConn, this is a matchup of last year's national championship game, a rematch. UConn against San Diego State coming up this week. Illinois is playing Iowa State in the Sweet 16, but I do have Illinois winning that one. UNC against Alabama, Clemson against Arizona, and that's the rest of the Sweet 16. So. Having said that, in the sports world, another kind of scandal is erupting. Say It Ain't So show. Shohei Ohtani, the Babe Ruth. I mean, probably better than Babe Ruth in terms of not necessarily the body of work, but what he's doing right now at the level he's doing it. The greatest player I've ever seen. Obviously, he's on the LA Dodgers now. And just a bizarre story is unfolding. He just addressed the media about this. I'm going to get to that in just a second. Producer Jim is going to update us. But Shohei Ohtani's interpreter, Ipe Mizuhara, was fired by the Dodgers on Wednesday because reports came out last week that $4.5 million at least in wire transfers were sent from Ohtani's bank account to a Southern California bookmaking operation that's actually under federal investigation to pay off gambling debts. So where it gets really bizarre here is that the story has changed from Ohtani's camp. At first they said that, Ohtani transferred the funds over to Mizuhara so that he could pay his gambling debts. But then the next day, Ohtani's law firm, Burke Brettler LLP, they released a different statement saying, Ohtani has been the victim of a massive theft from his interpreter, Mizuhara. And Ohtani allegedly, according to this news statement, had no knowledge of this guy's gambling debt. Ohtani hadn't transferred the money. And then the question became, well, how did this guy get his hands on it? Did he have the passwords for Ohtani's bank accounts? I mean, there's just so many unanswered questions. But the nightmare scenario for Major League Baseball is that Ohtani may have been involved in potentially betting on baseball. Now, is there evidence for this? Not at this point. But, and by the way, if this guy really stole money, the day that the story came out that the story was changed, that the interpreter allegedly stole the money from Ohtani, they were seen joking around in the clubhouse. They were in Korea at that time. The Dodgers were opening their season against the Padres in South Korea. That's when Rob Manfred, commissioner of Major League Baseball, found out about this mess. And this could be a scandal beyond. I mean, this is a nightmare for Major League Baseball. Let's face it, it's opening day. The Dodgers have their opening series set up against the St. Louis Cardinals beginning on Thursday. Your team, Jim. And what did Ohtani say? I didn't get a chance because he was given the press conference just as I was coming on the air. What did he say?
Yeah, so basically the gist of it is he's saddened and shocked that this whole thing is taking place, that Mizuhara stole these funds. And he's never bet on baseball or any other sport. Of course, you know, as you said, the rhetoric has changed over the past couple of days. Craig Calcaterra at the X app said, I genuinely feel bad for Ohtani today. It's 100% certain that the statement he's going to read was drafted by attorneys. If he's not answering questions, they should just release a statement. So we will see in the coming days, but not looking good.
Yeah, I'm assuming he took no questions, and he would obviously need a new interpreter now if he's fired this guy. So I don't know if he's got a replacement yet, but having said that, for Major League Baseball, notably in recent decades, obviously the Pete Rose scandal still looms large, going all the way back to 1919, Shoeless Joe Jackson, the Black Sox scandal. This would be, I don't know, maybe beyond that in terms of what's going on with Ohtani, the media. He's just absolutely a megastar the world over. So let's hope that there are no nefarious dealings and that he did not bet on baseball. But Major League Baseball has to deal with this. Absolutely. They can't have this in their sport. So lots of drama, lots of intrigue this opening week of Major League Baseball. But it's also a much more important week in our world. It's Holy Week. And don't forget, you can partake with Father Rocky in his incredible series, his Holy Week series of talks, his mission called Close to Jesus to the Last. It's coming up right now on Relevant Radio. Don't forget, go to relevantradio.com/holy-week for more special programming that we're going to have on the network. This is Cale Clark. Jim Shaper produced. Miranda Sinisteros took your calls. Talk to you soon. God bless you. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.